Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It's Wednesday, June 11th, 2014. Check this out.
The NSA breaks the law every day. It doesn't matter who you are or what you say. They monitor your phone calls and emails anyway. Corrupt Congress and courts paving the way. There's a lesson you'll learn someday. Watch what you say. See, they spy on your mind, record your calls for prosperity, commit daily executive crimes with impunity. They're the authorities here to keep us safe until the boot ends up on your face.
It's a new dance and rap video called NSA versus USA. Front and center is one of America's leading activists to restore the Bill of Rights. And a frequent contributor to this program, Shahid Buttar. Now, by day, he is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. But you lower the lights, turn up the beat, and Shahid can't help but start rhyming. And sometimes he's even done us a favor during our podcast interviews, where he'll lay out some rhymes without the requirement of beats or lowered lighting. Well, there's a lot to talk about today, and I opened with Shahid's new video. I'll put up a link to it in the show file so you can experience it all the way through for yourself. But we will get to the connection here in just a moment. The lead story in mainstream media and the amazing only story on MSDNC last night is the primary loss of the majority leader of the Republican House, Eric Cantor, in his gerrymandered district in Virginia. Now, Cantor drew the lines for this district. He's represented it, I think, for 7 terms. He had his own political machine that he had built up. But Eric Cantor was defeated by the forces that he helped unleash. The far right of the Republican Party often aligned with the Tea Party. And the college professor who defeated him, David Bratt, didn't even get a full endorsement from the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. Now, the corporate media has focused on a single issue, saying that David Bratt brought down Eric Cantor by painting him as a pro-amnesty apologist for immigration reform. And it's not really true. The allegation isn't. And it doesn't appear to be the sole reason why Republican voters decided to send Eric Cantor packing. We'll get to that in just a moment. Now, the gleeful cries of Democrats over this defeat, they hadn't even named a Democrat to run in this 57% Republican district. But yesterday they found somebody, and it turns out he's a professor from the same obscure college where this guy Bratt came from. And honestly, these district-level elections are often, you know, magnified into some sort of a national trend. And I don't think that that is indicated in this case, but it won't stop Nancy Pelosi from claiming that this injects new life in her efforts to recover control of the House. I don't see that happening. In most cases, the incumbents are easily winning renomination, and many of these states have fully gerrymandered their districts to make it virtually impossible for a Democrat to unseat them. Now, Eric Cantor has announced that he will almost immediately step down as the majority leader of the Republican caucus, and there will be a scramble to see who replaces him, and it is most likely to be one of the loudmouths from the far right in the Republican Party. And David Bratt is likely to win in the fall just because of the gerrymandering of the district, and he is going to go to Congress and oppose many of the compromises, the few compromises that Eric Cantor was blamed for by purist Republicans. Laura Ingraham, the shrill right-wing radio talk show host who now has a perch that helps legitimize her over at ABC News. She's one of the people taking credit for the scalp of Eric Cantor today. Now, Shahid Buttar, same guy you heard in the rap video just a moment ago, he put up a post on Facebook that I saw this morning, noting that this was not a single-issue campaign, that David Brat had also opposed the Wall Street bailout and blamed Cantor for the Stock Act, which would have stopped insider trading by congressional members and their families, and Cantor stopped it and changed the language. And Shahid points out that Eric Cantor was also one of the operators who changed the language of the so-called USA Freedom Act, the so-called NSA reform bill that actually makes things worse and allows the NSA legal rights that they didn't have before to collect our telephone records and other information on us. Well, he believes that David Brat had also made a case that the NSA's indiscriminate collection of data on all Americans is a disturbing violation of our Fourth Amendment right to privacy. And so it does appear that there is more in play in the defeat of Eric Cantor than the single-issue message that we're getting from the corporate media. And I think that it's a cautionary flag to members of both parties who have participated in the blind support of widespread violations of the Fourth Amendment by our government on innocent Americans on a massive scale. And I'd like to see more activism in these primary races focused around these critical issues. Maybe this is the real message of the defeat of Eric Cantor by David Brat. Meanwhile, in the formerly U.S.-occupied Iraq, the Sunni militants, who are said to be aligned with the radical forces in Syria, they are moving very quickly and now threatening Baghdad. They started north in the city of Mosul, which they took over in very short order. Now they have occupied the oil refining town of Baiji, and they have seized the city of Tikrit. And Tikrit, of course, is where Saddam Hussein came from. And what we are seeing here is the reemergence of muscular Sunnis. They are the minority group in Iraq, but Saddam was a Sunni, and that minority ruled brutally for decades. And now it appears that after being maligned and squeezed out of the government by our guy, Nouri al-Maliki, the Sunnis are back in bigger force than ever. And I think many people are stunned by this quick advance. These forces are now at the northern entrance of the city of Samarra, which is 70 miles north of Baghdad. This is happening very, very quickly. Now, here's another complication. The insurgents also raided the Turkish consulate in Mosul, seized the consul general and 47 Turkish citizens. This now creates a hostage crisis that loops Turkey into the conflict in Iraq. We have a very weak government in Baghdad. We have soldiers who are not standing and fighting with the Sunni insurgents. The stories come one after another that, for example, in Tikrit, residents said the militants attacked in the afternoon from three directions, east, west, and north. They said there were brief exchanges of gunfire, and then police officers and soldiers shed their uniforms, put on civilian clothing, and fled through residential areas to avoid the militants. So this is something that I have long suspected. We claim that we trained up, that we stood up a government, and we trained the military in Iraq to maintain security in that country. But the very means that we devised in the David Petraeus surge in Iraq was that we paid the Sunnis not to shoot Americans. We temporarily suppressed their violence and insurgency. We forced ethnic cleansing. We separated the communities, particularly in Baghdad, where Sunni neighborhoods were walled off from Shia neighborhoods. And by allowing Maliki to continue to marginalize Sunnis, we created the chemistry for this explosion that has occurred. And this is going to be very interesting to see whether Obama resists the calls from the far right in this country to immediately scramble and put troops back into Iraq and to provide air cover for this failing Iraqi military, which appears to be barely controlled by the Maliki government in Baghdad. And meanwhile, the Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, a Republican, was fielding questions mostly from angry Republicans about the swap for Sergeant Bergdahl of 5 Taliban prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And Hagel was, I haven't seen the video, but based on the written accounts, he came on pretty strong and rejected most of the false accusations that have come from John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and other right-wingers in the past week. Some quotes from Hagel. War, every part of war like prisoner exchanges, is not some abstraction or theoretical exercise. All of these decisions are part of the brutal, imperfect realities we all deal with in war. Now, while he did acknowledge and try to smooth some ruffled feathers of his former colleagues, you know Hagel was a senator, that Obama should have given them some notice, it's interesting because he's using a page out of the George W. Bush playbook. I don't approve of it. But he said, oh, I issued a signing statement that allowed me to ignore the law that Congress passed requiring 30 days' notice to release somebody from Gitmo. That's just what Bush did. So you can say that Obama is giving them a taste of their own medicine. But I called it wrong when Bush did it, and I call it wrong when Obama does it. I think the law never should have been passed, and the proper way to deal with that is a presidential veto, not a signing statement, and not simply a refusal to acknowledge the law that was imposed by Congress. Every day I pause to name some of the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. Today, Jeffrey Kay, that is Dr. Jeffrey Kay. Yes, he's the guy who writes for various publications. He's over at Fire Dog Lake most frequently now, who has uncovered the abuse of prisoners at Guantanamo and also the complicity of medical professionals, including members of his own trade, psychologists. So thank you, Jeff Kay. Also, Don Cisney, Bob Getzla, Julie Dupree. They are all regular subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I need their support. I really need your support if you're not currently signed up. And if you're able, I don't want your pension money. I don't want you to raid the cookie jar. But if you've got some cash and you can help support us, come on over. PeterBCollins.com. The link's under my picture. It says sign up. Takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of John Diss' rock and roll CD called Red Flag, and the other bonus gift is your bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. Today we release to those subscribers a very important interview about our failed juvenile prison system in this country. Author Nell Bernstein joins us for a revealing conversation about her new book called Burning Down the House. And there's some tough, tough information in here about the way children who commit minor offenses, sometimes just dissing a cop, and because maybe their parents are in jail or using drugs or there is no home for them, they wind up in a juvenile facility for a very minor offense. And that experience hardens them and becomes the basis for the single most powerful marker of someone who will go to adult prison, and that is a record of having been in juvenile detention. Here's an excerpt from that powerful interview with Nell Bernstein.
Nationwide, the number of juveniles in locked facilities has dropped by 40% over 10 years. And you mentioned California. The California Youth Authority has gone from over 10,000 kids to a few hundred, it's something that would have just seemed unimaginable a decade ago. And I think that money is a driver there. You know, on the one hand, there are financial interests in building prisons because they create jobs, often in rural counties. But at a certain point, when state budgets just don't balance, when there really is no money for schools, which are funded at about a tenth of the level of juvenile prisons, the tide began to turn.
And Nell, you elicit information here in the book that the annual cost of locking up a juvenile has risen to as much as a couple of $100,000 per person. Now, that's an end-to-end cost. I recognize that. But
no, it's an annual cost.
It's a real cost.
Yeah. That's in California, and my understanding is that the average nationwide is $88,000, but it did get as high as $225,000 per kid in California per year. And my understanding is the reason for that is the cost of these lengthy multiple lawsuits because of conditions. In other words, we as taxpayers weren't just paying to incarcerate kids, we were paying the cost of keeping them in abusive conditions. And I think that was another motivator for change. I went in with much more of a reformist attitude than I came out with. My fear about these drops in population that are primarily fiscally motivated is that the economy changes. And I'm concerned that when we have more money, if we don't change the way that we think about kids, we'll just fill the places right back up again.
You can hear the full interview with Nell Bernstein released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. Now, speaking of young incarcerated people, we have a fresh complaint, and it's not a new problem, but it's a fresh complaint. A group of five organizations filed a complaint with the Department of Homeland Security on behalf of 116 unaccompanied immigrant children. While they have more than 100 complaints, they believe thousands of children have been subjected to inadequate food and water, verbal abuse, sexual assault. One in three reported that the prison confiscated and did not return money or belongings. About 15% reported being forcibly separated from family members. And this is now being magnified because of this wave of young unaccompanied children who've been pouring over the southern border. 47,000 of them this year. And now we're setting up new facilities where new types of abuse can occur. Fact is that these immigration prisons that we run are the black holes of the American incarceration system. People there have no rights. They're widely abused, sexually abused, physically abused, denied fundamental human rights like access to an attorney and contact with family members. It is grossly shameful, and it's been going on for a long time in this country. And Obama hasn't done a thing about it. Here we go again. A Florida man who bought weapons from an undercover FBI agent and planned to blow up a popular Tampa entertainment area was found guilty and faces life in prison. Despite testimony of his lower-than-average intelligence and psychosis, this man, and forgive these terms, but I want to make it very clear here. The FBI has framed a moron with psychotic tendencies. Because once again, the pattern plays out that they infiltrated a mosque. Someone there fingered this 27-year-old Sami Osmakok. I don't know if I'm saying his name right. Then they equip him with an FBI informant who supplies the weapons that he was going to use in his scheme. We've heard it over and over again. And the government gloats, the jury's verdict in this case represents another victory in our fight against terrorism. Yeah, they're going to lock up another guy with a low IQ who was dumb enough to get entrapped by an FBI agent. And next week, we'll have an in-depth interview we're scheduled to record on Tuesday with Steve Downs, who is retired and has come out of retirement to address some of these cases of FBI domestic prosecution of alleged terrorists that usually involve a paid FBI informant. And we will bring you more details in that conversation next week. Well, a new study shows that on college campuses in this country, crime is down sharply, with the exception of sex offenses. And sex offenses have increased sharply. And we discussed this yesterday with the case of the Coast Guard court-martial here in San Francisco Bay. Our military services are rife with sex criminals. Our college campuses are places where sexual predators seem to operate at will and with great impunity. And these statistics, you know, are tough enough to detail. There were 3,330 forcible sex offenses reported on campus in the most recent year of the data, which is 2011, a 52% increase from a report the report a decade earlier. And that the number of crimes reported on campus overall has declined in all categories except sex offenses. Would you send your child to a campus where you knew that he or she might be sexually assaulted? And why is it that the college and university administrations are able to suppress information about this? We have a case here at Stanford where a man who was accused of date rape and was found guilty in a campus process was suspended from future studies but is being permitted to graduate, and now the dispute is over whether he can actually walk and accept his diploma at graduation. Now, I don't know the particulars of this case, and I want to stipulate that there are sometimes false charges brought. But if the process was accurate and this man was found responsible for violating sexual assault rules, should he be graduating? Should he be allowed to attend the graduation? I find it remarkable that this is so compartmentalized and not really responded to by way too many people. The European Union's top antitrust official has opened an investigation into the way countries like Ireland provide tax arrangements that enable big multinational corporations like Apple to dodge tax bills worldwide. And last week, California's Governor Jerry Brown was at an event with the Prime Minister of Ireland. And it was supposed to be off the record, but Brown made a joke about how much money Apple Computer says it makes in Ireland that it doesn't pay taxes on. It's some $30 billion a year. And that was spun as criticism. Brown said he was joking. But in any event, these are really important issues. That $30 billion that Apple doesn't pay American taxes on, that could go a long way toward any program that you care about, even reducing the deficit. But Apple skates. And I really don't have much confidence that this investigation will go very far. But any exposure of the tax evasion by American-flagged corporations, in my view, is well warranted. And finally today, teachers have taken it on the chin in a court decision announced yesterday in Southern California. This is a superior court, so it's the lowest court ruling, and it will definitely be appealed. But in this case that was brought by a group called Students Matter, teacher tenure was found to be unconstitutional. And they were able to make the case before, who is, you know, clearly a sympathetic judge, that the number of teachers who are grossly incompetent in California is so high and that it remains unaddressed because the process of firing them is so difficult that this, you know, presents a constitutional problem for the well-being of the students. And I find that thinking bizarre. I think you're comparing apples and kumquats. And I don't have a particular stake in teacher tenure, and I will acknowledge that in California, it is too hard to fire a bad teacher or a teacher who has broken the law. But there are ways to address that through processes that don't involve simply removing tenure rights from all teachers in California. That is quite extreme, and I cannot imagine that appeals courts will ultimately uphold this. But the other thing I found interesting, because all the cable shout channels were focused on the Eric Cantor loss on Tuesday evening, I turned off that stuff and I watched the PBS NewsHour. And they did a decent job of covering this California court decision. But when it came to describing the plaintiffs in the case, they showed pictures of these students. And they made it seem like these students got together after class and said, hey, you know, let's find a lawyer and let's sue to overturn teacher tenure. Well, that would be the impression you might have if the PBS NewsHour was your only source of information. And even in the San Francisco Chronicle that devoted quite a bit of space to its coverage of this story, they identify the man who paid for the lawsuit. He is a Silicon Valley millionaire, billionaire. I don't know how much money he has. His name is David Welch. And he started a couple of companies, made a fortune, and has turned his sights to promoting his own views of education reform. So he funds this nonprofit, Students Matter, but he wasn't interviewed or even identified on the PBS coverage of this story. And I hadn't really heard much about David Welch, so I looked him up. And it turns out that the attorney he hired for this case is none other than Ted Olson, the Republican stalwart who, for one case only, neutralized his partisanship to help David Boies and the legal team overturn Proposition 8, which was an attempt to withdraw civil rights from same-sex couples in this state. But David Welch has the money to hire a gunslinger like Ted Olson, and he did. And so we'll see how all this plays out. But once again, the corporate media coverage of an important case like this is obscuring the real players and the real checkbook that brought this case to court in the first place. Hey, thanks for listening today, and please support our new Facebook strategy. You've got to like the Peter B. Collins Show page, then use the same button to click on Get Notifications.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.